Today, we will cover the right-hand side of the Einstein equation. Not the whole thing just yet, just the right-hand side, the energy-momentum tensor. So what is it about energy and momentum in general relativity? As I mentioned before, they are not conserved in general. In actual space-time, energy and momentum are not conserved. And yet, of course, they're very important quantities. So we'll need to find out how to define those quantities, even though we cannot identify them through conservation laws. And secondly, under which circumstances would there be conservation? Okay, so let's begin by reminding ourselves of the situation in flat space-time. In flat space-time, in Minkowski space, the invariance of the action under time translations and under spatial translations implies, respectively, the conservation of energy and the conservation of momentum under Noether's theorem. So that is what is used when you study the motion of rockets, of satellites, and so on. How about fields? Now, fields are all over the place all the time, unlike a rocket that's at one place at one time. A field is always everywhere. And a similar thing holds true for fields as does for individual particles. Physical fields, the presence of physical fields implies that there are, at every point in space and in time, flows of energy and flows of momentum. In the Minkowski space, they are conserved flows. As much flows in, as much also flows out of energy and of momentum. Now, in curved space-time, there is no translation invariance in time or in space in general. And therefore, the flows of energy and momentum will generally not be conserved. So how can we identify them if not through conservation law? Noether's theorem allowed us to prove the conservation of energy and the conservation of momentum. And in the process, we defined what is energy and what is momentum. Now we'll have to do that separately. And the key idea for that purpose is this one. Energy and momentum are almost conserved, after all. The only thing that prevents them from being conserved is the curvature of space-time. So therefore, whatever plays the role of the flows of energy and momentum, even though they're not conserved, whatever plays their role must be very sensitive to any perturbations or to any non-triviality in the curvature of space-time. Therefore, let us study the quantity that measures how the dynamics changes with the change of shape of the space-time. What quantity would that be, if you're not checking what I wrote there already? Remember that the action knows everything about the theory. Because if you know the action of a theory, you can get from the action the equations of motion. So the laws of nature that we know about are encoded in the action that we write down. To check how the laws of nature, how the dynamics changes with the curvature, is to check how the action changes. Because the action has everything. So let us calculate how the action changes under a change of shape of the manifold. Let us look at the quantity tau mu nu. This is supposed to be a large tau, and it has nothing to do with the torsion, even though we used the large tau for that too. This is a large tau, and it is going to be the functional derivative of the action with respect to the metric, so with respect to the change of the manifold. Remember, though, that the metric tensor contains the information about the shape of the manifold in a very redundant way. The same metric tensor can be written in many, many different ways, by changes of coordinates, by diffeomorphisms. So this is a redundant way of encoding it. We have to deal with this redundancy a little later. But definitely, we are capturing, by differentiating the action with respect to the metric, the change of the action and therefore the change of the dynamics with the change of shape. Also, we are inadvertently, even though we are not keen on that, we are also covering the change of the action and the change of coordinates, right? And the change of under diffeomorphisms as well. We get that along for the ride with the change of shape. All right, so we will define this quantity here, and clearly the flows of energy and momentum will have to do something with that. But how do we define this in the first place? How do we define a functional differentiation with respect to the metric? Our definition is this, very analogous to how we functionally differentiated earlier with respect to fields. Now we functionally differentiate with respect to metrics. We say that g mu nu of lambda in x is a deformation of the metric parameterized by parameter lambda. It's a deformation in the region B. B is some region of the manifold. If the following statements hold true, A, the deformation function here for the value lambda equal to 0 is supposed to be just the original metric again. So if lambda equal to 0 is the no deformation case. And of course, when it is deforming for lambda not equal to 0, we expect a smooth behavior with respect to lambda. I'm just not spelling this out explicitly. And also, we want that it's not deforming the metric outside the region B. So we are varying the shape of the manifold, but only inside the finite size region B. Outside, we just keep the manifold the same. So it grows wrinkles, it grows bubbles and dents and crevasses and whatnot inside the region B. But outside the region B, we leave it untouched. And then we will write, as a matter of convenient terminology, that the differentiation of the metric with respect to lambda at lambda equals 0, we call delta g mu nu. That's the variation. Okay? So the delta is, by definition, just a name for this derivative here. And that is an ordinary derivative, right? The derivative of this function with respect to lambda, to the parameter lambda. Then we make sense of this definition here in the following way. We say that the action is functionally differentiable with respect to g mu nu in the region B if this quantity exists for all smooth deformations for all of those g of lambda and x, and if this derivative is actually of that form, which in smooth cases is automatic. Maybe this is a little bit overly precise. For the purposes that we're interested in, everything is smooth enough that this is guaranteed. So the functional derivative is of the form that ds by d lambda is the integral over b, and then this functional derivative times delta g mu nu of x d4x. You can think of the integral over b as being something like the sum over all variables, and then we are functionally differentiating with respect to x, and then with respect to g, and then with respect to lambda eventually. One thing to note about this is that this functional derivative here, in principle, could be anti-symmetric, could have an anti-symmetric component and a symmetric component. But the way that we are doing here the Taylor expansion, after all, this is just the first term in the Taylor expansion of the action with respect to the metric. The way we do this, we are differentiating with respect to a set of variables that are symmetric in mu and nu. And therefore, automatically, this first order Taylor term contributes only with its symmetric part. If tau had an anti-symmetric part, it would drop out simply by virtue of the perturbations of the metric also being symmetric. So in principle, we could drag along an anti-symmetric part, but that would bite us later. So we just keep only the symmetric part, and there is no antisymmetric part to tau. This is a little non-trivial, because in special relativity, the way you derive the analog of the tau in special relativity, it would generically come out not to be symmetric. But in GR, it comes out symmetric in this way. It's a natural choice. And we will later see why that is really the natural choice. So then we write that ds by dg mu nu, which has to be something with upper indices, because this thing has lower indices, is that tau. And the factor 1/2 is a matter of definition, of convenient definition. Now, we might have hoped that the tau comes out to be a tensor, but not so fast. It's not actually a tensor yet. Why is the tau mu nu not a tensor? It looks like one. It has two upper indices. It looks like the component functions of a twofold contravariant tensor. But that's not yet a tensor. See, this is a scalar, the action. And we differentiate with respect to a parameter. So that stays scalar. So the whole thing over here on the right-hand side is clearly, by construction, a scalar. And here we have something that's twofold covariant. Why would that not be twofold contravariant? Well, it's not because that's not a covariant measure. This is not a volume form. This is a volume form, right? So we know that this is a volume form. And that is a tensor. We know that. So this will be a tensor as well. So you see, from this equation to that equation, all I've done is I've introduced the 1 over square root of g, which is, remember, square root of absolute value of the determinant of g. And here, it's inverse. So that hasn't really changed the equation at all. But now I can group things in such a way that we can identify a volume form here. That's covariant. This is a twofold covariant tensor. So that whole thing is a twofold contravariant tensor. And anything that needs a division by square root of g to become a tensor is what is called a tensor density. So if, or in the other way around, if m is a tensor with, if these are the component functions of a tensor, so many times contravariant, so many times covariant, then if I multiply it with the square root of g, then it becomes a tensor density. Just a matter of terminology. Mm-hmm.
I don't understand, because whatever square root of g is a constant, right?
So no, it's not a constant. It's a function. Remember that g is a function of x in general. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why it matters. OK, so the tau mu nu with two upper indices is a twofold contravariant tensor density. But it's easy to turn that into a tensor. We simply divide by the 1 over square root of g, right? So we simply and call that a t mu nu. And that's that thing here, right? So that now is a tensor, twofold contravariant tensor, or it's the component functions of a twofold contravariant tensor. There we go. So our definition is that t mu nu, which is this expression here, which is the functional derivative of the action with respect to the metric, a factor of 2 that will be convenient, because then it later matches other definitions that come from special relativity. And we divide by square root of g to make it a tensor rather than a tensor density. T mu nu obeys a very important equation, and that is this equation here. When I covariantly differentiate in a new direction and I contract the new indices, then that is equal to 0. We will do the proof a little later. This equation looks like conservation of energy, perhaps. It looks like something is conserved. But that equation doesn't mean energy or momentum conservation. And it cannot, because there isn't. Right? So in GR, there is no energy momentum conservation. What would it mean? What could it possibly mean then? Any guesses what it could mean if it's not energy momentum conservation? There are certainly non-trivial equations. It turns out that these equations hold true because there's redundant information in T. If you remember, we said that we calculate the derivative of the action with respect to the metric, because we wanted to find out how does the dynamics, which is encoded in the action, because the action knows all about the equations of motion. We wanted to find out how does the dynamics change with the shape of the manifold. But by differentiating with respect to the metric, we were getting much more than we were bargaining for, because a lot of changes in the metric are not changes in the manifold at all. Those changes could be had by simply diffeomorphisms, by changing coordinates. So this means that this matrix-valued function here has a lot of junk in it. That is just knowing about diffeomorphisms, and no shape change has taken place to obtain that information. Those four equations that we have here, there are four equations after all, because the nu is being contracted, so you can just run the mu from 0 to 3. Those four equations express diffeomorphism invariance. As we will see, this is how we will prove the equation. So we know that they are eventually Bianchi identities. Now remember, we set out with the following strategy. We said energy momentum is not conserved, but whatever energy momentum are, they're going to be very much related to the derivative of the action with respect to the metric, because the change of the dynamics because of curvature of space-time is what messes up the flows of energy and momentum, makes them non-conserved. That's why we defined T mu nu in the first place. Now we need to identify how T mu nu really relates to flows of energy and flows of momentum in the case of fields, and how it relates to the actual momentum and the actual energy of a particle that travels around on a geodesic. So we need it for the particle picture and for the wave picture. So to that end, let us consider a space-time that has a symmetry. In this case, we can hope for a conservation law when there is an actual symmetry. This is motivated by Noether's theorem. So let's say we have a manifold which is in the shape of some ceramic. So you've done some pottery, and the whole thing turns out to have some non-trivial shape like this. But let's say it's rotationally completely symmetric, unlike the drawing that I attempted over there. But assume it is sort of rotationally completely symmetric, okay? So that kind of manifold has the property that if you apply a diffeomorphism to it, which simply rotates every point by a certain angle, well, then you get back the same manifold. There's absolutely no change if you map each point into its rotated point. The same wouldn't be true if instead of doing a horizontal diffeomorphism of the kind that I just explained, if you did a diffeomorphism that's vertical, that wouldn't work, right? Then you would not get the same thing back. Okay, so in this case, there are diffeomorphisms phi from the manifold into the manifold, such that when you do the pullback of the metric, you get the same metric again. The metric that simply doesn't change if you map all the points on the manifold to the point that they flow to under the flow of that diffeomorphism. So now we expect that corresponding to that symmetry of the manifold, there ought to be the conservation of something. Let's try to identify what that might be. It turns out that it suffices to study infinitesimal symmetries, as also in the case of Noether's theorem. You don't have to have a finite translation symmetry. You don't have to use the symmetry under finite translations to derive momentum conservation. Even infinitesimal, the invariance under an infinitesimal translation suffices to derive momentum conservation, and similarly for energy conservation from infinitesimal translations in time. Okay, so we do that for infinitesimal symmetry transformations, and we can always build up finite ones from those if we want to. So let's say our diffeomorphism phi from M into M is a diffeomorphism that maps coordinates x prime into coordinates. So that's not x prime, that's x mu So it maps coordinates x mu into coordinates x mu plus xi mu. So xi mu is a vector field that generates the flow. So at the point x mu is mapped into the point x mu with these coordinates added. And by our assumption, we have a symmetry here, which is to say that the pullback of the metric gives us the metric again, which we can identify from previous lectures as meaning that the Lie derivative of the metric is vanishing. Okay? So the metric tensor does not change under the flow generated by the vector field xi. So any vector field xi, in this case, the vector field that generates the flow that is flowing around our pottery item, a vector field xi, which in a region obeys that the Lie derivative of the metric in that in the direction of that vector field is vanishing, we will call a killing vector field. This has nothing to do with murder. There is a guy whose name was killing. Okay, so killing vector fields obey that equation. How can we find killing vector fields? If we don't start with the pottery, if we're given with just a metric, then how do we find out whether or not it has a killing vector field? There's got to be equations to solve. And of course, here's an equation, but let's make this a little bit more explicit and a little bit more convenient. First, this proposition. The Lie derivative of a tensor in the direction of a vector field xi can be written in this way, where we have the, this is not the tensor itself. Remember, these are the coefficient functions. So we have the covariant derivatives of the coefficient functions here, leaving the vector field the same. And then we have terms where we leave the tensor coefficients the same, but we covariantly differentiate the vector field coefficients, and we get a minus sign for the case of the covariant indices, and we get a plus sign for the case of the contravariant indices, and everything has to be contracted just right with upper contracted with lower indices. We had this formula again almost. When we derived that formula, we didn't have covariant differentiation yet, if you remember. That was before that. We did the Lie derivative before we did the covariant derivative. Therefore, we couldn't have had that equation. But we had something very similar. We had that equation with commas instead of semicolons. Right? We didn't have semicolons yet. We didn't have covariant differentiation. So we had that equation, and now I'm suddenly claiming that is also true when we replace the commas with a semicolon. Now, first you might ask, why would I want to do this? Because the semicolons are much more involved to evaluate, because they involve not just the ordinary partial derivatives. No, you get the Christoffel symbols as well, right? So it's many more terms if you do that for the covariant derivatives, for the semicolon. So explicitly written out, it's many more terms. So why would I want to do it? Well, I want to do it because later on, there will, you know, we want to do that for the metric. And the metric tensor with the semicolon, covariant derivative of the metric tensor, is vanishing. That was the statement that the affine connection is compatible with the metric. That was the key equation that linked the affine connection to the metric approach. Covariant derivative of the metric is vanishing. So if we want to make use of that, we better write this in terms of semicolons, covariant derivatives. See, if this is the metric, then that will be the metric, and that will be a term that's vanishing. But why would it be true? OK, so we know that this equation is true when we have ordinary commas. Now, imagine we write it down with ordinary commas, and we choose the origin of a Riemann normal coordinate system. At the origin of a Riemann normal coordinate system, the gamma symbols, the Christoffel symbols, vanish, zero. Therefore, at the origin of the Riemann normal coordinate system, we can, without penalty, make the comma semicolon, because there are no Christoffel symbols. They're vanishing at that point anyway. So at the origin of a Riemann normal coordinate system, this equation holds with the semicolon. But an equation that a covariant equation like that holds in one coordinate system holds in all coordinate systems. And therefore, that equation also holds no matter what coordinate system you choose with the semicolon. It's quite a non-trivial thing, but that's why we try to understand things a little bit more abstractly. It can save us a lot of calculation. So let's apply this now to our condition of symmetry. Remember, the manifold has a symmetry, just a sec, in the direction of the flow generated by vector field psi if the lead derivative in that in the direction of that vector field vanishes. Now let's calculate that. Mm-hmm.
The argument you just presented for replacing the commas by semicolon, I don't see how it depends at all on what that equation was.
That's true. It's true for all equations that hold with just a comma. All of those equations will also hold with semicolons. The other way around, of course, doesn't hold true, right? But if you have, in differential geometry, an equation that holds with the commas only, which is a rare thing to happen, but if you find one, you can always put semicolons there too. And we will find that to be the case a little later, for example, with the homogeneous Maxwell equations. Again, you can write them with the commas. That's how we had them originally. You can also write them with a semicolon for exactly the same reason. Good. So let's apply that. What is the lead derivative of the metric? Lead derivative of the metric, here we have the same formula as above. Just instead of having some abstract capital Q, now we have the metric itself. Let me just show you both. Here we go. Okay, so I'm replacing Q with the special case of the G of the metric. And then we get, as promised, the semicolon, the covariant derivative of the metric coefficient. And here we have the g, and in this case, we are differentiating the vector field. This thing is vanishing because of the compatibility condition between the affine connection and the metric. And so we find that the vanishing of the lead derivative of the metric in the direction of a vector field psi is equivalent to this condition. And we can use, you see, it's just that this plus that is vanishing. We can use the metric to pull down that index, and this metric to pull down this index. And we put one of those terms on the other side. And then we find this equation here. So the condition for a vector field to generate a symmetry, to generate a symmetry of the metric, and therefore to generate a symmetry of the manifold, of its shape, that condition is this. This is the Killing vector field condition. And we will come back to that several times. Just think of it this way. You take your vector field, a covariant vector field, lower index. Now you take the semicolon nu of it. That combination, which is a covariant, a twofold covariant tensor, this thing, this twofold covariant tensor has to be antisymmetric. This is what it says. And that antisymmetry will be very useful and important. So let's assume that our spacetime has a symmetry. So let's assume that there is at least one vector field psi such that this is true. Can we now identify a flow using this T mu nu? Can we identify a flow that is conserved? Here's the proposition. And we start out with the particle picture. No, actually, this will be the field picture. So for every symmetry, for every Killing vector field that a spacetime possesses, its matter fields possess a conserved quantity. And the flow vector that is conserved is the contraction of this T mu nu tensor that we calculated earlier, the derivative of the action with respect to the metric, and then 1 over square root of g, and multiplied with 2. That thing contracted with psi mu, our Killing vector field, that gives us a vector field. And that vector field describes a flow which is conserved. Whether that is a momentum flow or an energy flow, we will find out in a moment. It depends, actually. It depends on the character of the psi. But the point is of this proposition that this matrix here indeed knows about flows of energy and momentum. And if indeed there is a symmetry described by, generated by a vector field psi, whose flow is generated by a vector field psi, then the contraction of psi and the t mu nu doesn't really matter whether you contract with the nu or the mu because the thing is symmetric, gives you a vector field p mu which is conserved. Let's prove that. So we calculate the so-called divergence. If you remember, we had that, I think, last lecture. Calculate the divergence of the vector field p. So p mu contracted with semicolon mu. That is, by definition, the t mu nu contracted with the psi, and then semicolon mu and contraction over the mu. By the Leibniz rule, we have to covariantly differentiate the first tensor, leaving the second one alone, plus the other way around. So we differentiate the first tensor, the t mu nu. By the way, now I can reveal what this thing will be called, the energy momentum tensor. So we take the energy momentum tensor and calculate its semicolon mu, covariant derivative in the mu direction, contract that, leaving the psi alone, plus by the Leibniz rule, we leave the first tensor alone. And then we have to take the covariant derivative in the mu direction of psi. Now, the first term here is vanishing because the t mu nu has this magical property that the semicolon mu contracted with the mu is vanishing. Remember, I promised you we will show that this is a Bianchi identity, that this is following from diffeomorphism invariance. It's true no matter what. The manifold may or may not have symmetries. This is always true. And it's not a conservation law in itself. It's just always true. And the second term that we obtain is that t mu nu contracted with this psi nu semicolon mu is vanishing. And that's vanishing because the t mu nu is symmetric. But this covariant, twofold covariant tensor, is antisymmetric. Remember, that was the condition of the Killing vector field, this one. So this is the covariant 2 tensor, and it is antisymmetric. This is the statement that psi generates a symmetry. This is the statement that psi is a Killing vector field. So this divergence vanishes if and only if this thing is antisymmetric. So if we have a Killing vector field, that thing is always vanishing. But that's not enough to get that the divergence of p is vanishing. No, we also need that this thing is vanishing, and that happens if psi is a Killing vector field. OK, so if psi is a Killing vector field, then that divergence is vanishing. You may not see immediately why that is a conservation law. Although we had a similar case earlier, let's just spell it out explicitly in integral form. So p mu semicolon mu is vanishing, right? That's what we just typed in the equation above. This is equal to 0. Therefore, if I integrate it, if I multiply it with something, I integrate, it's still 0. Right? So 0 equal to the integral over that thing that's vanishing times square root of g d4x. And that's 0. Now, this is a divergence, if you remember. And the divergence of a vector field p for the volume form omega, that was the volume form omega, is actually via Gauss's law that. I hope you remember what this was. We can also rewrite it as a leader derivative. We can also write it as the exterior derivative after the inner derivation, plus the inner derivation after the exterior derivation. And so overall, what we get is the integral before Gauss. We get the integral over b, and then we have d, exterior derivative, on the inner derivation. And using Stokes' theorem, or Gauss's theorem, we can turn that into an integral over the boundary of B and getting rid of the co-boundary operator. And so we have that. I think we did that in the last lecture again. If you want to see that again, see me after class, and you can go through those steps. Or try it yourself first, and then we can talk. OK. So what we have is this conservation law, which is to say that if you integrate the inner derivation of the volume form in a direction of P, which is really, what is it again? You take the volume form, which takes n inputs, and as the first input, you plug in the vector field P. Right? That's what the inner derivation was doing. The inner derivation is simply taking an n form, and you plug in the direction vector field, in this case the P, as the first argument. And then you're left with an n minus 1 form. In the n minus 1 form, you can integrate over the n minus 1 dimensional boundary of the region B. Okay, so what this is saying is that the integral over the boundary of the region B in our spacetime is vanishing of this flow, which is to say that whatever goes in goes out as well. We will do that in much more detail later as well. But let me again stress that the statement that T mu nu semicolon nu equals zero is not a conservation law in itself. It's just a Bianchi identity. And mathematically, that's because you have to be careful with one thing. This is a divergence, where you have a contravariant vector, and then you contract it with its covariant derivative in the mu direction. That is the divergence, as we showed earlier. However, if this thing had another index, just like the T, the energy momentum tensors, two indices up there, if it had another index, then the whole thing here is not a divergence. For this to be a divergence, this has to be a contravariant vector field. Otherwise, it just doesn't match, doesn't work out. So what have we conserved here? Is it energy or is it momentum? It depends. If the killing vector field is time-like, that is, if it generates a time-like translation, then the flow described by the conserved vector field, so you know that's the vector field K mu, which is obtained by taking the energy momentum tensor and contracting it with the vector field that generates the flow, then this flow of well, this flow is then, in this case, an energy. So if the symmetry is a time-like symmetry, if it's a translation in a time-like direction, then we call this flow that is conserved an energy flow. Otherwise, it would be called a momentum flow if this is a space-like symmetry. As in the case of the pod ray, it would be space-like. And we will also get, of course, angular momenta and so on. So the T mu nu of x, because it contains information about energy and momentum, is called the energy momentum tensor. Notice what we've done here. We've identified a tensor that makes sense, that is well defined as the functional derivative of the action with respect to the metric, whether or not there's a symmetry. It's always describing a flow. You can always contract that with a vector xi, and you get a direction vector xi, and you get a vector k in this way. So you take your T mu nu, contract it with a direction vector xi, and then you get a flow in that direction. It doesn't have to be conserved. It will be conserved if there's a symmetry, but you definitely get a flow. And later on, we will get all kinds of energy theorems for general relativity that are useful or important for all sorts of theorems regarding the unavoidability of a black hole forming, for example, at a collapse. And those energy conditions, those so-called energy conditions, will always be conditions about such flows. In situations where there may not be a conservation law, you may still want to say something about a flow being positive, a flow being finite, a flow being zero. That kind of condition can be imposed on such flow vectors k, even if there is no killing vector field. So this was the flow associated to vector fields, to fields, physical fields, will generate an energy momentum tensor everywhere, and there will be a flow associated to that. Because fields are everywhere, there will be energy and momentum flows everywhere as well. But what if we have just one particle that travels in a lonely way on its space-time? How about its energy, its momentum? Under which circumstances does it have something like energy or momentum that are conserved? So again, let's start out with the assumption that our space-time has a symmetry. So it has a Killing vector field psi. The metric doesn't change in the direction generated by psi. Now consider a particle that travels on a geodesic. If it doesn't travel on a geodesic, then there's got to be a reason for that, which means external forces. If there are external forces, we should not expect that its energy or momentum are conserved. So we are considering a particle that travels on a geodesic in a spacetime with a symmetry. Now we have a chance for a conservation law. And the claim is that the quantity that you obtain by taking the tangent vector on the geodesic, gamma dot, gamma is the path, the geodesic path, gamma dot is the tangent vector. If you contract that with the Killing vector field, you get a scalar quantity, and that scalar doesn't change along the path. That's a conserved quantity. And it will be called an energy, and it will be called a momentum, depending on whether this thing is time-like or space-like, whether the Killing vector field is time-like or space-like again. For the proof, we can calculate that directly. So we just calculate the covariant derivative of that. So the covariant derivative in the direction of the geodesic, let's call it geodesic u, just so that we don't have to write a gamma dot all the time. Doesn't matter. So the u is the tangent vector to the geodesic. So we take that scalar here. And we can take the coefficient function in front out of it, if you remember. That's the uk here. And then we have a covariant derivative of the xi, leaving the u alone. We have the xi left alone and covariantly differentiating u. Gives us two terms. The uk is always in front of everything, because that's the uk coefficient, which we can always pull in front of a covariant derivative. So there's the uk in front of it. Then we have the semicolon to be applied to each of the two factors. The uk, and then the semicolon applied to the xi in this term, leaving that u alone. And in this term, we leave the xi alone, and we covariantly differentiate the u. The claim is that this total derivative, the derivative of q along the path, is vanishing. Why would that be? This term is vanishing because the product uk u mu is symmetric, but this tensor is anti-symmetric. Really, to see this, we have to lower that index, and we have to raise those two indices. I mean, the mu goes up. Okay, so the xi with the mu as a lower index and the k here, that's an anti-symmetric tensor, if you remember. That was the condition for xi to be a Killing vector field, namely that its first covariant differentiation is anti-symmetric. So that thing is anti-symmetric, but the two u's here are symmetric, so the whole thing is vanishing. And the second term is vanishing because this particular combination, the uk and then u mu semicolon k, is really the covariant derivative of u in the direction of u. It's the covariant derivative of the tangent in the direction of the tangent. It's the parallel transport of the tangent in the direction of the tangent. And that is vanishing is the condition for a geodesic. So this is vanishing because our particle is traveling on a geodesic. Therefore, that contraction here is really conserved in time. And it is an energy. It is called an energy if xi is time-like, which means, in practice, for Minkowski space, that xi is 1, 0, 0, 0. And it's called a momentum if the vector field, the Killing vector field, is one of those where we have an entry on the space-like components only. But of course, all of this applies the same way also to black holes and other complicated situations. Now, let's come back to this key property of the energy momentum tensor, namely that when we apply the Cobain derivative to it and then contract the two indices, this is vanishing. Remember the intuition for why these equations always hold. Remember, they hold even before we choose equations of motion for gravity. They hold before we choose what action our matter fields ought to obey. These are purely structural equations. And here's the intuition. T mu nu was obtained by functionally differentiating the action with respect to the metric. Now, among all those variations of the metric that we considered, many are really neutral. They don't change the shape of the manifold. These are changes of the metric from g mu nu of x to g tilde mu nu of x, which are g mu nu of x plus some variation of the metric, which do not change the shape of the manifold, because as we go from mg into mg tilde, actually there is a diffeomorphism that maps the two into each other, a metric preserving diffeomorphism. There's a mere change of coordinates that that relates them. But the T mu nu depends on all changes of the metric, those that do change the shape and those that don't change the shape. So therefore, we, as we discussed earlier, we expect the T mu nu to contain redundant information, which means there ought to hold equations among the coefficients of T mu nu independently of what the shape is of the manifold. And these are those equations, as we will now show. First, we can estimate how much information is redundant in there. Well, the claim is that it's diffeomorphism invariant that is the source of the redundancy, is the source of those equations that always hold. How much diffeomorphism invariance is there? Well, diffeomorphism invariance means that we can change coordinates to any other coordinate system we like. So we can go from an unbarred coordinate system, x0 to x3, to a barred coordinate system, x0 bar to x3 bar. And any such diffeomorphism is specified by specifying four functions in a 3 plus 1 dimensional spacetime. Namely, we have to specify x0 bar as a function of the variables that we used earlier. We have to identify x1 bar as a function of the previous variables, etc. We have to specify all the four new coordinates as functions of the old coordinates. So we can choose four functions freely to pick a diffeomorphism. Therefore, we can expect that there are four equations that express redundancy in T mu nu, and indeed they turn out to be those four equations. Let's now actually prove this. So let's assume that phi t is some diffeomorphism that is generated by the flow of a vector field psi. So if t is equal to 0, then we have not flown. The flow has not taken anything anywhere finite. And as t grows larger, the flow is over longer distances. And let's assume that the diffeomorphism is mapping only a finite region of our manifold into itself, some region B. So we assume that phi of p is p itself for all values of t if the point p is outside that finite region. We can view it this way, that we allow ourselves to relabel the points inside that region B, but we keep the labeling, we keep the coordinates of the points outside the region B. You can really just think of this as a relabeling of everything. Now, every integral, including the action integral, is invariant under change of variable. Every integral, always. If you do your change of variables correctly, you're not changing the value of the integral, right? And that is true also if you change your variables only infinitesimally. So you go from variables x to variables x tilde, where x tilde is x plus a little bit, just some infinitesimal change. So here's our action, here's the Lagrangian, and we integrate that over. The square root of g is considered to be part of the L in here. And this is our action written in variables x. This is the action written in terms of variables x bar. We will normally write a Lagrangian density with a curly L and a Lagrangian with a square L. Remember, the Lagrangian is a scalar. The Lagrangian density is a scalar density. Remember, the density of a tensor has the square root of g built into it. The tensor itself doesn't. The tensor itself would still need a square root of g in here. So since this has the square root of g absorbed into it, we don't call it a scalar, we call it a scalar density. And then we write it with a curly L, otherwise we would use the regular square L. Okay, so this is in one coordinate system, that's in another one, same value. So in particular, since the one is a diffeomorphism of the other, we can write that 0 is equal to, and that is purely decorative at the moment, the 1 over t, but it will come in handy later. 0 is the Lagrangian here minus that Lagrangian there, and I'm writing it as the diffeomorphism, as obtained from the diffeomorphism phi star t from that Lagrangian over here. And I can choose to make that Lagrangian smaller and smaller. I'm just making those coordinates more and more similar to the coordinates over there. Now, we can approximate what that is when the diffeomorphism is very small, when they're very close. Then we have the change of the Lagrangian density with respect to the vector field, and then multiplied with the change of the vector field, right? So this is dl by d psi, and then this is the d psi, the variation of the change in the vector field. The vector fields minus the diffeomorphism transported phi. Plus, and then we have dl by dg and the change in the metric. Now that first part here is vanishing because we are assuming that the equations of motion hold. So if the equations of motion hold, then dl by d psi is vanishing. So we are choosing our psi to be solutions of the equations of motion, so that thing is going away. Now what do we have here? Here we have the change of the Lagrangian density with respect to the metric. And in this, we recognize the energy momentum tensor. This is up to prefactors of 1/2 and the square root of g, just the energy momentum tensor here. And what is that? That is the metric minus the metric very close nearby, and then pulled back to the point where we started. And there's a factor of 1 over t over everything, where t is the parameter that parameterizes how far we flowed. So as t goes very small, this is the approximation that we did here, t very small, the two coordinate systems being very close. This actually becomes the Lie derivative here. This is how we define the Lie derivative of a tensor. You take the tensor minus the tensor at a nearby point where you float to, and then with the pullback, taken back to that tensor space where your point is, around which you are calculating the derivative. So as we take the limit for t going to 0, and you see we're doing it the physicist's way today, as we take the limit for t going to 0, we obtain that the original statement that an integral is independent of the coordinate system in which you calculate it, that was that 0 here, remember? Whether you calculate the action in one coordinate system or another one, doesn't matter. The difference between the two is 0. That's this 0 here. That's the difference between the two. This 0, the independence of an action integral under the choice of coordinate system, turns into this expression down here. So we have that the diffeomorphism invariance means that 0 equal to this, the derivative of the metric here, and here we have the energy momentum tensor. Now remember, the Lie derivative of the metric simplifies. We had this just three slides ago. The Lie derivative of the metric is given by, well, three terms. It's the covariant derivative of the metric, leaving the xi alone, and then leaving the g alone, and covariantly differentiating the xi, contracting with one of the two indices of g, and then doing the same thing again, now contracting with another index of the g. This thing vanishes because of the consistency condition between affine connection and metric. The covariant derivative of the metric is vanishing. That's this condition here. So we can write the Lie derivative as the sum of those two terms, which we now do here. So we have that diffeomorphism invariance implies that 0 equal to energy momentum tensor, and then those two terms coming from here, times square root of g, and the whole thing integrated. This term is symmetric. Energy momentum tensor is symmetric. And here, this thing we can write as something that is symmetric plus something that is anti-symmetric. So what I've done here is I've pulled the index down. So I interpret the metric as, I just use it to pull that index down and to pull this index down. Now we have this expression here. It's just the same thing, right? I just wrote it differently. Now that combination here can be written as twice xi b semicolon a minus xi b semicolon a plus that. See that? Right? So I just added and subtracted a term. So this is ba plus ab. Ba plus ab. I added another ba term and I subtracted it again. The point being that I'm now getting this bracket here, which is something that's anti-symmetric. And because it is anti-symmetric, it contracts with the symmetric TAB to 0. So this term goes away. And I can write, I can replace this simply by twice xi BA. That's what we have here. Energy momentum tensor and then xi BA. OK, so this thing is vanishing. Diffeomorphism invariance means that this thing is vanishing. Now we can write this in a different way, too. We add and subtract terms. So we write it as the same thing again. The factor of 2 goes outside. And then we add and we subtract that term. The point is that in this way, we can write these two terms as arising from Leibniz rule, namely as that term covariantly differentiated. See, if I take that term and covariantly differentiate it, I get the covariant derivative of the t, leaving the xi alone, plus, that would be this term, plus a term where we leave the t alone and we covariantly differentiate the xi. That's this term. OK, so we turn these two terms into this one term, which is covariantly differentiated. If you look closely, you will notice that that had a good purpose, because that is a vector here. right, is a vector. It has only one free coefficient, one free index. It's a one-fold contravariant vector here that I'm taking the semicolon off and contracting. So that's going to be a divergence. Okay? Divergences are very good because then we can integrate by parts, and because we have a boundary condition on our variation, that thing will vanish eventually. And then we are left with this one term. I just carried that forward here. So let's just complete this argument with the divergence. This is a divergence. Let's call that vector R superscript A. So of course, really just the coefficient function of a vector. So R superscript A is the coefficient functions of a vector, contravariant vector. And we take here the semicolon A, contract with A. This thing is a divergence. And by Stokes' law, we can write it like that. But since our variations are actually vanishing at and outside, at the boundary and outside of the region B, we have that this is vanishing. Remember, the psi is vanishing on the boundary and outside. This is generating the flow, and the flow is we don't change the coordinates on the boundary or beyond. So that thing is vanishing, that entire term goes away, and therefore we are left with just this one term here. So diffeomorphism has given us the statement that this one term is vanishing. This one term is vanishing. Notice here that we have a contraction over the semicolon k. And that's true for all vector fields psi. Don't have to be Keeling vector fields or anything. This was just any vector field that generates any change of coordinate. We have that this is vanishing. And since that's so, that vector TA, remember, this is just a contravariant vector here, TA has to vanish itself. So we have that this equation follows from diffeomorphism invariant. For each A, there are four of them, so we have four equations there. So they really just express that it doesn't matter in which coordinate system you evaluate an action. So all of that has been a little abstract. Let us calculate something explicitly, because there are some pitfalls with evaluating the energy momentum tensor explicitly. And remember, we need the energy momentum tensor on the right-hand side of the Einstein equation, so it's really important. And also, it will be important for your project, because energy and momentum determine the equation of state parameter and so on. So how to calculate the energy momentum tensor? It seems all we have to do is differentiate the action with respect to the metric. Here's the action. Just differentiate with respect to the metric. It would seem to be straightforward. However, let's look at it closely. So we differentiate the action with respect to lambda, where lambda is this parameter of the variation. Remember that we have a variation g mu nu of x and lambda, and we are differentiating with respect to that lambda. So what we do is we differentiate L, the Lagrangian scalar with respect to the metric, and then multiply with dg by d lambda, but dg by d lambda was the variation of g. Plus, we differentiate L with respect to the fields, physical fields, and then vary the field. That's not going to contribute, because actually we are not varying the fields, so that thing is going to go away. The only variation that we are considering here is the variation with respect to the metric. And then we also have a differentiation, a functional differentiation with respect to square root of g. So that's this thing. And then there's one more term, namely the functional differentiation of the Lagrangian with respect to the covariant derivatives of the matter fields. and the variations of the covariant derivative. You see, we went about it very systematically. Here's an action, and we simply vary everything that's in there in order to get the functional derivative. We vary L with respect to psi, that was here, and then we said, we can drop that because we're not varying the psi. And then we said, okay, we functional differentiate the L with respect to the covariant derivatives of psi. That was this term down here, and we are suspecting that that might vanish as well because we are not varying the psi. So why would the covariant derivatives of psi vanish? Why would the covariant derivative of psi not vanish? And then we also have the functional derivative with respect to the square root of g to be taken. That was over here. And then, without spelling it out explicitly, of course, the Lagrangian has occurrences of g all over the place in it, because there can be covariant derivatives in there. So there will be dependencies on g in there, and we have to functionally differentiate with respect to them. That was the very first term, dl by dg, variation of g. But now, that should give us a hint about that term too, this one, dl by d psi. That's a major pitfall here. We do actually have to differentiate L with respect to the covariant derivatives of psi in order to get the full functional derivative of S with respect to the metric. And the reason is that the covariant derivatives of psi don't only depend on psi. They also depend, because there's a covariant derivative, also on the metric and on the variation of the metric, right? So actually, this thing is not going to vanish, even though that is. So if you ever find yourself calculating energy momentum tensors, be careful to take that term into account as well, because that will depend on the metric as well, through the Christoffel symbol. Because the covariant derivative, this semicolon, has Christoffel symbols in it, they will give us extra terms. So the variation of a covariant derivative of a matter field is going to be given by the derivative of the covariant derivative of the matter field with respect to the affine connection. And we do know they do depend on the affine connection, and then the variation of the affine connection. Remember, we calculated the variation of affine connections. More precisely, at some point, I said, what if in nature there is another affine connection? What if there are two of them? Maybe we have two kinds of parallel transport and whatnot. But then we saw that the difference between two affine connections is actually a tensor. It transforms tensorially. So we can remember that now and say, aha, if we vary the affine connection, the variation of an affine connection is actually tensorial. Even though the gamma Christoffel symbol itself is not tensorial, the variation of it, being the difference between two of them, and then the limit taken for epsilon going to 0, is actually tensorial. So even though this equation may not look tensorial, it is. You differentiate with respect to that, and these delta and del, they are actually tensorial. That's a covariant thing to do, as it has to be, because the action is scalar, so the whole thing has to work out tensorially. Okay, so the variation of the Christoffel symbol is a tensor, we said. And in fact, the variation of the Christoffel symbol is given by this expression here. It's the variation, it's expressed in terms of the variations of the metric, which are, remember, dg by d lambda. And you can derive that most easily in geodesic or normal coordinates, where these are ordinary derivatives and so on. But let's not go into the details for that. So what we obtain then is that the variation in the covariant derivatives of the matter field is given by d psi by d gamma times this business. So all I've done is said, okay, we have to functionally differentiate the Lagrangian with respect to the matter field's covariant derivative, covariant derivatives. and then vary the covariant derivatives, which have gammas in them. And this thing, here I wrote it again, is given by that, d psi by d gamma. And here's the delta gamma, and the delta gamma can be expressed in this way. So overall, this thing, which is over here, and this whole thing is being integrated over, that thing can be written in this way. That variation of the covariant derivative of the matter field is given by this lengthy expression here. Oh.
Thank you.
Okay, so we are almost done now. We have to do one more thing. Remember, this is the functional differentiation of the action with respect to the metric. And we want to calculate that to get to the energy momentum tensor. We have some expression times the variation of G. Some expression times the variation of G. This thing is vanishing. And here we have some expression and something ugly. We want also some expression, variation, delta G. Right? We want something or other times delta GAB over here, just like here and there, so that we can then collect everything that's in front of the delta GAB, this piece, that piece, and whatever comes from here, and call it the energy momentum tensor. How do we do that? Here, we don't have delta GAB yet. Instead, what we have, instead, what we have is this business. That's not yet delta GABs, because they are covariantly differentiated. So what we do for that purpose is we have to do an integration by parts. So we integrate by parts. How do we do that? We add and subtract a term, collect two of them using the Leibniz rule, then show that what we get is a divergence, which goes away at the boundary. And then we are left with the negative of those terms, with the semicolons now on everything that they multiplied. And so we obtain eventually, I'm cutting short a few lengthy lines, but I'm sure you can do that yourself. You get some terms multiplying delta G mu nu. And now you can collect everything together. And you get that ds by d lambda is some collection of terms that have three sources, as we showed earlier, multiplied with the delta g mu nu of x square root of g. And this piece we identify then as the energy momentum tensor. So just very quickly, you notice it has three sources. It comes from dl by dg. The energy momentum tensor has a contribution from that, from l d square root of g by d gab. This thing you can calculate yourself or look it up in textbooks. This expression takes a few lines as well. And also, there is a contribution that's often overlooked, where you differentiate L with respect to the covariant derivatives of the matter field. OK, so here's an example. How are we doing with the time? OK. Here's an example. Scalar field, Klein-Gordon field. We have the covariant derivative of a scalar Klein-Gordon field. And we contract that with, well, covariant derivative of the scalar field, covariant derivative of the scalar field contracted. That's a scalar with a minus 1/2 in front of it. And then we have also a potential for the scalar field. This could be a phi to the 4 potential for the Higgs field, for example, or some quadratic potential for an inflaton field, and so on. Now, let's see, for a scalar Klein-Gordon field, what is the energy momentum tensor? Very important case for cosmology. For example, for the Klein-Gordon field, for the inflaton field, where we don't quite know what the potential is, but a lot is known about it. I will say more about it later on, later in the course. So in this case, we have to differentiate the action with respect to the metric. So we differentiate this term here, and we get the variation of the g. That's easy. Remember that we have here covariant derivatives in principle, but since the psi is scalar, we get away easy because the covariant derivative of a scalar is the ordinary derivative, if you remember. So therefore, we don't actually have a further variation in here. There are no Christoffel symbols in here. So it's easy to do the functional derivative of that with respect to the metric. We just get this. Then we get another term where we functionally differentiate this piece. And that is obtained, the two terms actually, functionally differentiating this and multiplying with the potential, and functionally differentiating that, leaving this thing alone. So leaving that alone and functionally differentiating that gives us this term here. Leaving that alone, because that doesn't have the metric in it anyway, and multiplying with the functional derivative of this term with respect to the metric gives us that. Now, the derivative of the square root of the absolute value of the determinant of the metric with respect to the metric is given by that expression here, which is, as I said, something that can be calculated, but it's a little bit tedious. Another thing that we note is that the variation of the metric contracted with the metric is the variation of the Kronecker delta, which is vanishing. The Kronecker delta is the Kronecker delta. It's just the variation of it has to be zero. But the variation of that zero is the variation of this, leaving that alone, plus leaving that alone, varying this. So we get that expression here, which tells us that the variation of the metric with two upper indices is minus the variation of the metric with two lower indices, and then the indices raised. So that's a little non-trivial, but it's clear from this calculation. So keep in mind that you can't just get to the variation of the metric with the upper indices by raising indices. You also have to put a minus sign there. I mean, it's sort of plausible because the G with the upper indices is actually the inverse matrix of the G with the lower indices. So now we have everything together, and we can calculate what the variation of the Klein-Gordon action is with respect to the metric. We get these terms, where, I mean, it's just the three terms from above. Remember? These three terms. And we just put in what this is, the square, the derivative of the measure factor here and there. And then we also used the fact that this becomes a variation with lower indices if we add a minus sign. So overall, we obtain that the variation of the action with respect to the metric is given by this expression here, where all of the differentiations have been carried out. And all of the variations of the metric are variations with lower indices now. And over here as well. So therefore, we can collect everything that multiplies the variation of the metric together, all of these terms, and here, and identify what the energy momentum tensor density is. And from it is this expression here. From that expression, notice I raised the indices here, but we might as well lower them. You may not be familiar with having semicolons upstairs, but you can have them upstairs as much as you like. Raising and lowering indices commutes with covariant differentiation because the covariant derivative of the metric itself is vanishing, right? You need the metric to raise and lower indices. But since the covariant derivative of the metric is vanishing, you can always do that as much as you like. So overall, if we now take that energy momentum density and divide with the square root of g, And multiply with a factor of 2, we get the Klein-Gordon energy momentum tensor, not the tensor density. Don't multiply with a factor of 2, that's when you differentiate the action. But between the two of them, the only difference is a factor of 1 over square root of g. So we just get rid of the square root of g here. We obtain the Klein-Gordon energy momentum tensor here. Let's look at it in this form a little bit more closely. You see I've also lowered the indices in this line. So we have covariant derivative of psi, covariant derivative of psi. Actually, because they are scalars, you might as well drop these dots and may have it just comma. But it looks more covariant in this way, and though it's not any more covariant otherwise. And then here we have the semicolon of A contracted, and the G mu in front. The G mu is also providing the indices for that term. Here we have the potential. As it is, this energy momentum tensor came out symmetric. As it is, we don't have to delete any anti-symmetric part. This is symmetric in mu and nu, as you can easily verify, because this is and those guys are. You can check for yourself that in the case of the electromagnetic field, the energy momentum tensor looks very different. It's this expression in the case of the energy of the electromagnetic field. And again, it is symmetric if you check the expressions. Now, very important comparison is the following. It's a comparison with a perfect fluid. So far, we've calculated the energy momentum tensor of a scalar field. Now let's look at a perfect fluid, and we will see that it has an energy momentum tensor that's very similar. And on the basis of that similarity, cosmologists use expressions that come from the world of fluid dynamics and use them for fields. For example, pressure. Pressure is something for fluids. But we can read off what the analog quantity is for a scalar field, and that's where the terminology comes from. Let's do that now. This goes back to Hawking, Ellis, and a few others in the 70s. A perfect classical fluid has at every point a unique time-like flux direction vector, v mu. There are fluids that are not perfect. Let's say you take a fluid which is a photon gas, and let's say the photons are flowing mostly in this direction. And let's say in that fluid you also have neutrinos. And let's say they mostly flow in that direction. That's not a perfect fluid. You don't have at every point a unique time-like flux direction vector v mu that tells you in which direction the stuff is flowing. Right? So you can easily come up with complicated fluids that are not perfect ones. So a perfect classical fluid, and it's emphasized, it's classical. This is not a field theory, just a classical fluid, has at every point a unique time-like flux direction vector v mu. That flux is conserved, and the fluid is completely characterized by its local energy density and its pressure. There's just no more to say about the fluid. You know everything about it if you know the pressure and the energy density and its flux direction vector there. There are no parameters for shear or viscosity for a perfect fluid. And it turns out that for a perfect fluid, the energy momentum tensor is given by this expression here, where you have that this is the vector that describes in which direction the stuff is flowing. This is the energy density, that's the pressure, and here the pressure occurs again. One example of a perfect fluid is dust. That's a fluid without pressure, because it's assumed that the dust particles miss each other. Okay, so there's no pressure there, and that occurs in cosmology quite a bit. For example, today, the universe is filled with what is very well described as dust. It's just that each grain of dust is what? You have any idea what the grains of dust are in there? That's right. It's a whole galaxy. Tough job for a vacuum cleaner to clean up that mess. Okay, so perfect fluids are parameterized by energy density and pressure. So for example, the equation of motion is actually, the equations of motion are actually these, the Bianchi identities, as they just happen to be that, in the case of dust, in the case of pressureless perfect fluids, and those dust particles would then travel on geodesics. According to Hawking and Ellis, and people have been sticking to that suggestion, the terminology is that any fluid which has this energy momentum tensor will be called perfect. Fluid dynamicists may not agree with this because there's so many other things you can, just to say, so many other things you can worry about in fluids, but for cosmologists, just like even light is matter, everything that's not gravity is called matter in cosmology, and everything that's not hydrogen or helium is called a metal, even carbon, right? So anything is called a perfect fluid which has this energy momentum tensor. Yes. No, it does. Yes. Yeah, we want the flux to be conserved, but we will get to that in much more detail a little later.
I thought you couldn't have an incompressible fluid as long as you had a finite propagation speed.
So you said incompressibility?
Yeah.
No. It can be compressed, of course. You know. A gas of dust, of course, can be compressed in this case. Sure. But you have a continuity equation. Okay, so now a very important definition that you will also need for your project is this one. The so-called equation of state of a perfect fluid is the relationship between its energy density, mu, and its pressure, P. This equation of state depends on the fluid in question. Some fluids have some relationship between energy density and pressure, and other fluids have other relationships between energy density and pressure. And the quotient between pressure and energy density, that quotient W with the pressure upstairs, that quotient is the equation of state parameter. For a given fluid, that number can change. You can have that at very high densities, for example. That number has particular value. At low densities, it can have another value. Your fluid can undergo phase transitions, for example, and then things will look differently. The behavior of pressure relative to energy density can change. We will get to that in more detail. For example, as the universe is diluting, it goes from one value of the energy of state of the equation of state parameter to another value of the equation of state parameter. Now, for that comparison, important later for cosmology is the fact that the two tensors that the two energy momentum tensors that we have so far, the energy momentum tensor for a Klein-Gordon field and the energy momentum tensor for a perfect fluid, PF for perfect fluid, those energy momentum tensors actually have great similarities. Here is the energy momentum tensor for a perfect fluid. By definition, everything that has that is called a perfect fluid. And the energy momentum tensor for a Klein-Gordon field is this one, which has calculated that, which is very different from what you would have for the electromagnetic field, for example. So now let's assume, in order to make this comparison a little closer, let's assume, I mean, you can already see where this is going, right? The V mu is going to play the role of the psi semicolon mu. And the G mu nu term here, everything that's multiplying the G mu nu term is going to play the role of the pressure, right? So it turns out that we can often assume that the spatial derivative of the scalar field is not all that large, that its time dependence, because it's oscillatory, is dominating over its space dependence. We will use that a few lines down. So now we identify the V mu vector with the normalized version of the psi semicolon mu. See? Remember that those guys are normalized. They don't come normalized. So we normalize them. Then, so we identify the V mu's with the normalized versions of the derivatives of the scalar field. And then we can write the Klein-Gordon energy momentum tensor in this way with the V mu here. We can compare that with the energy momentum tensor of a perfect fluid, which also had a term V mu, V mu, V mu, V nu, and the G mu nu term. Remember, it was this one, this term here. So now we can read off what is energy density plus pressure, and what is pressure alone. And in particular, we can read off what the quotient is between the two. So let's do that. Oh, and just a sec. Things simplify, of course, when the spatial derivatives of the scalar field are small compared to temporal derivatives. That was this condition over here. Then this equation becomes approximately that one. In cosmology, that's usually the case, that we don't have the things change much across the universe, but they change a lot over time. So now let's compare with the perfect fluid. Let me just move that a little bit like this. OK, so we have that mu plus p is this stuff. And the p is all of that. So we have that mu plus p over p is this, and therefore that, divided by p. P is all of this. So we have that mu plus p over p, which is mu plus p, which is 1 over w, plus 1, is given by, and this is from our identification what the mu plus p is, and that is from our identification above, that stuff here, which is what the pressure itself is. And I already did it for the simplification that is important in cosmology, where the spatial derivatives drop out compared to the time derivatives. They are small. So now we get a handle on what the W parameter is for a perfect fluid. Of course, we can calculate from this also what the energy density and the pressure is. But later on, we will find out that more important or a more convenient variable than the energy density and the pressure is the equation of state parameter, because it will directly enter into the equations of motion for the dynamics of space-time. And what we see is that a scalar field, a scalar Klein-Gordon field, has a equation of state parameter, W, which is given by this expression here. I'm just taking that equation here, writing this plus 1 specifically out, putting all of this on a common denominator, and obtaining that result. Taking the inverse of it in order to get W rather than 1 over W, we get that W is given by that. That is a key equation for cosmology in general and for your project in particular. What it means is that a scalar field, and remember that, well, not remember, but you will see that in cosmology, it is thought that the very early universe was completely dominated by the behavior of a scalar field. That scalar field produces an energy momentum tensor, which is very similar to that of a perfect fluid, with an equation of state parameter, with a ratio between pressure and energy density, W, which is given by that, which is the kinetic term, the time derivative squared, half of the scalar field, minus the potential, divided by same thing, plus the potential. Key thing that we can read off from that is that if the early universe was dominated by a scalar field, then the equation of state parameter has to have been between minus 1 and plus 1, depending on how big that potential is compared to those kinetic terms. If the field is changing very quickly, then this W parameter is pretty much close to 1. Because if this is large compared to V, you can forget about the V term. It's basically one. If, on the other hand, the potential term is tremendously large, then we can forget about these terms, and the W is basically minus one. It has to be somewhere in between the two. As it turns out, it seems that the experimental evidence points towards W being smaller than minus one. Now, at this day, which is very weird, because any kind of matter that we know of, now to be dominant in the universe, wouldn't produce that. Dust, the dust of galaxies, doesn't produce this. A W smaller than minus one, and a scalar field doesn't either. So it's curious. It's not yet completely confirmed that W is smaller than minus one now. And it's up to you to find out what it would mean for the future of the universe if it really is smaller minus one and stays smaller minus one. But a very different question is also a very important question is, where does it come from? Apparently not from a scalar field. Something else weird must be going on to make W smaller minus one. Something very weird. Okay, that's it for today. And on Thursday, we'll do the Einstein equation.